Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
Hey, J. Michael Michael here, and if you're like me, you love talk radio. And if you're like me, you just can't find the right radio stations for your habit on the AM dial. Well, tune into LA Talk Radio. That's right, LA Talk Radio has it all. And right now, we have the writer's favorite show, The Writer's Block. So sit back, put your feet up, and enjoy it, because it all starts right now.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Russ Avison right here on LA Talk Radio.
It is a Thursday evening. This is LA Talk Radio, and this is The Writer's Block. My name is Jim Christina. I am your host for the evening, in studio with my occasional co-host, good friend and dog trainer, Russ Avison.
Hey, I always want to go woof woof when you say that.
We are trying something new tonight, so Russ, why don't you clue us in?
Well, I'm not very clued in myself, but what we are attempting to do is put this show on Facebook Live.
Uh-huh.
So if you go to Writer's Block Radio, you should be able to see both of us, and it's actually a 360-degree camera, so you can touch the screen and scroll around. You can look at Jim. You can look at me.
You don't want to look at me.
No, probably stay
more. Probably look at Russ.
Yeah. So anyway, go ahead and do that, and you can actually even make comments to us if you like.
And that's at facebook.com/writersblockradio. So you can go there and you can see all of it live. You will not be able to hear our guest, but if you listen to the podcast at the same time or listen to the show at the same time, you'll be able to get everything. So that being said, I'm going to give us a little bit more of Trevor Jones and Promontory, which is the opening or the ending sequence to Last of Mohicans. Okay. All right. How you doing, Russ?
I am outstanding.
Yeah?
Yes, I am.
Yeah?
I don't know why, but I am.
You know, I watched your thing on Judge Judy again.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I did. I had to, because I had to see how many words you actually did speak.
It was very few.
Oh, it was like four.
I know. It
was yes, I do.
I know. You know, someone actually sent me a you know, I got a lot of text messages when it was on. Uh-huh. And somebody wrote and they said, the way to win on Judge Judy is keep your mouth shut.
Well, they were probably right because you won.
Yeah, I did. It was fun.
You know, it's just like, oh, well, you know, let's just do what we do and then, you know, we'll just keep doing it.
Yeah. But yeah. I had a good time and it was a good experience.
I'm absolutely sure it was. Yeah. I'm absolutely sure it was.
I will say the only thing that really ticked me off is that when you go on that show,
uh-huh.
Okay, everybody who appears gets an appearance fee.
Sure.
So the woman that I sued,
uh-huh.
Okay, she got an appearance fee for being on the show. And the show actually pays the penalty. Whoever loses, the mm-hmm. show pays that.
Uh-huh.
So she walked away scot-free and made money.
Yeah.
Out of screwing me out of the money. So there was nothing punitive.
Yeah, but then they go out there and then they'd go out and tell a story because it didn't really cost them anything.
Yeah, well.
Well, I had to pay them $400. And, no, you didn't. You know. Judge Judy reached into her pocket and gave him $400.
That's exactly right.
You know, I mean, hey, let's call a spade a spade.
Yeah. But it was a fun experience anyway.
I've got a couple little short announcements tonight to make, and one of them I have to tell you is it's like around California and the United States, these burger joints are popping up. And Simi Valley now has one, and I have to say that the bookie and I, she talked me into going there last night for dinner. And the place is called Smash Burger. And
I've seen it.
And if you haven't tried one, oh, my God, they are so good.
Really?
Yeah. The fries are, like, better than McDonald's. The burgers are outstanding. Everything is fresh. Everything is cooked right there.
Did they pay you for this?
No. Oh, okay. No, this is a freebie.
Wow.
So Simi Valley on 1st and LA Avenue, right across from the Shell Station. There's a smash burger there. If you go, tell them the Writer's Block sent you, and they'll be thrilled because we gave them a card last night and said, listen in. We're going to mention you guys.
Excellent.
Okay. Now, next, we have a good friend of the show, actually a good friend of ours, and Bobby Jeans. And he's been on the show before, and he's been at almost every cowboy festival. Troy V. Smith, he's a writer. He's a wrangler. He's a buckaroo. He's a screenwriter. He's a, does pretty much everything.
Can I ask an ignorant question?
Sure.
What's a buckaroo?
A buckaroo is kind of a guy who wears cowboy clothes and does cowboy stuff.
Oh, is he really a cowboy?
He is really a cowboy.
Oh, okay.
And actually, the book that he wrote while his back was broken, and he wrote it on his back on the couch with big ballpoint pins upside down on a yellow legal pad.
Really?
He did.
Wow.
And when the pin didn't write anymore, he threw it, and he grabbed another one, and he kept writing. So anyway, Troy's wife, Susie, who was a favorite of everybody, passed away about 3 weeks ago, I guess. Oh, and we all missed her because Susie was just the sweetest, nicest thing. So, Troy, if you happen to hear this, our thoughts and prayers go – not even our thoughts because that's so dumb. Our prayers go out to you and hope that things are working out okay. And I know you're going to miss her. And she was a really great lady, and we will certainly miss her. Okay. And then we want to, last thing is another good thing. Our other co-host in this show, Bob Brill, made a little short 10-minute movie a couple months ago.
Yeah.
And he put it up for consideration for an award. He actually won it. And it is the Chaplin Movie Award for the best movie, for the best short movie.
Really?
And Bob Brill won it. So congratulations, Bob, and I know you won't forget to come next week. So
well, did cash go with it? I mean,
I don't know.
Is he taking us all out?
We will be asking him next week. Yeah. But yeah, good old Bob Brill, our little short guy from KNX Radio, actually won an award. So congratulations, Bob, and I know you're not listening. I'll remind you. I'll send you an email and tell you to listen to the podcast. Okay, tonight's guest, she's sitting right here on the phone, lady from New York. She's a librarian by profession. Actually, Jerry and I know a library lady. Well, Eleanor is one. She's a librarian. And it's Eleanor Kuntz, and she is the winner of the 2011 Mystery Writers of America Minotaur First Crime Novel Competition for A Simple Murder. And The Devil's Cold Dish is the book that we'll be discussing tonight and shortly because we want a lot of her process because this woman's terrific. It's the fifth novel in her Will Rees mystery series. She is, of course, as I mentioned, a lifelong librarian. She is currently employed by the Goshen Public Library in New York. Would you please welcome to the Writer's Block, Eleanor Kuntz. Eleanor, are you with us still?
Yes, I am.
Okay, then.
Welcome, Eleanor.
Welcome, welcome, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you know what? It's just an honor. It is. We don't get many librarians around here, so, you know. We don't actually have that many people that can read.
So. We're lucky if they can find us on the radio.
We are. I mean, you know, if people actually can find – actually, we have quite a big listener base. But if they can find us, God bless them. So you have written a series of books about Will Rees, and we're going to discuss your latest one here in a minute. But this is a character that goes back a ways, and I guess I'd like to ask the question, where did he come from? Was he just a total figment of your imagination, or is he someone that you knew or composite of people that you knew?
Or is it your husband?
Or was it your husband?
No. He's actually based on my father.
Ah, see?
My father wasn't a weaver.
Uh-huh.
I made him a weaver because that's one of my hobbies. And they'd say, write what you know. So, and I actually know something about it. But my father was one of those people who could do anything with his hands.
Okay.
And I wanted to pay tribute, in a way, to a time where that's what people did to make a living. They worked with their hands.
Yeah, they did. Now, this is actually textile weaving you're talking about.
Yes.
Okay. Because, I mean, you know, I mean, Dennis Weaver was, I don't think he was a textile weaver, but he was a weaver.
He was, that's true.
There probably was a weaver in his background.
Oh, somewhere. I'm sure there was. Yeah. I'm sure there was. That's a very good point. Okay, that's two for Eleanor, none for Jim. So, anyway, then we come up to the Devil's Cold Dish. And this is a story that takes place in 1798. Is it 1798? Somewhere
97,
there?
97, actually.
97, okay, in Maine.
Yeah, try and get it right, Jim.
I did. you know, I'm struggling here. I just, it's a long day, and then I have to get on the radio and talk for an hour. Okay, in Maine, Dugard, Maine. And, of course, he is a weaver, and he's got a wife and five adopted children and his son, David. Mm-hmm. And why don't you tell the story, because it's quite interesting.
About the Devil's Cold?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just sort of a little thumbnail sketch of what the story's about.
Give us however much you want to give us. We won't give away anything at the end.
Okay. Well, I actually was inspired to write this from the research that I did on the previous book, A Death in Salem. I went to Salem several times, and of course, this book is about 100 years after the witch trials. But the witch trials are still very present in Salem. They have the cemetery, they have houses from that time, and they have a lot of little plays all over the place about the witch trials.
Mm-hmm.
And I started thinking, if you are in a small town and your friends and neighbors turn against you, how do you recover? I imagine, even though they didn't have the phrase then, you had PTSD. And the accusations of witchcraft did not end then. They continued right up in New York, for example, to 1816, right in a few miles from where I'm sitting now.
Mm-hmm.
So accusations of witch trials and witch trials continued for quite some time. So I put Will Reese and his family in that position, where he is accused of a murder that he did not commit, and his wife is accused of witchcraft.
Right. Right.
And then, of course, everything spools out from from that.
Sure, everything goes downhill from there.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, too.
Yes. Well, I mean, speaking of downhill, I had to drag that body downhill, which is kind of cool. Over the hill, over the dale, over the rocks.
My mother was a Mainer, so we were in Maine quite a lot, and I lived in Maine for a while, and I based that hill on a hill in Acadia Park that I hiked. So my sympathies were with Will Reese at that point.
Mm-hmm. Well, Russ and I were talking about this book yesterday, and we both pretty much had the same comment in that you almost needed a program to remember which character did what. And mm-hmm. I don't know how the hell you did it. You got it right on, but you wrote the book. But how do you keep your character straight? Because you do have a lot of characters in this book.
I think probably this book has some more than usual. But, of course, a lot of them are repeat characters.
Mm-hmm.
There's Will Reese, his wife, his children. They're all repeats. And a lot of the other characters are also repeats.
Right.
Sister Carolyn, his nephew, the constable. A lot of them are repeat characters, so they are from the other books.
Mm-hmm. But if you haven't read the other books, you're kind of lost.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it took me in the very beginning.
Yeah.
The first chapter or two, I had to reread over again, so I kind of got the name squared as figuring out who went with who.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's good to know. I'll keep that in mind for the future.
Or just,
I don't want to confuse people.
No, just slip a page in there.
Or you could rewrite the whole book.
Or you could.
That'd be a little hard since it's been out now for a couple of years.
I actually wound up having to do that in a book that I did because there were so many people that I couldn't even keep track of them all, and there were a lot of them were repeats. So finally, at the end of the book, I just put their names, birth date, died, and what they died from.
Oh, brother. Wow.
When you put way they died, did you say I killed them?
No.
Because you kill off your own.
I do. But no. I just put, Buck Simpson.
Yes.
1837 to 1887, died of natural causes.
Ah.
Mm-hmm. You know.
At 40 years old.
At the ranch, at 40 years old, yeah.
Yeah. By the way, just to mention again, there's some people listening, and they're sending messages.
And is that right?
They're apparently not listening to the podcast. They're trying to listen through Facebook.
Oh.
So if you want to hear the caller in particular, you've got to listen to the podcast.
Right.
We don't have the audio feeding through Facebook.
Well, you go and listen live, and that way you get everything, plus you can have the video.
Yeah, there you go.
And don't look at me, because I just look at Russ.
I'm looking at you.
He's looking at you, kid. Mm. Okay, so you this terrain and everything, I mean, the terrain that you write about is a big part of this book. And the farm, and then, of course, his wife, is it Lydia or Linda?
Lydia.
And Lydia. She, of course, is pregnant, and then, of course, she's also being labeled a witch, mm-hmm. which carries through the entire story. It's kind of, you know, it's wow, he just had shoved a lot of stuff in there.
Well, I had her labeled a witch partly because it's a story about malice.
Mm-hmm.
And also because the Shakers were suspect. And she's a former Shaker.
Well, yes. Now, are they still? I mean, you know, I know the Shakers are still around, and I know they build really cool furniture. Well, mm-hmm. pretty plain stuff, but it's expensive. But are they still, like, on the cusp of witchcraft or being accused? No?
No, they really are almost idealized now. There are only three of them left, by the way.
Is that right?
When I was researching my first book, there were 11.
Uh-huh.
But there are three left now.
Original Shaker people.
Shaker people, yes.
Holy
and
man.
You can still join the Shakers if you wish.
Wow.
I could join them. There'd be four.
Still take converts.
Did you hear what Russ said? He could join and it'd be four.
yeah, he'd be four. But
well, let's all join. It'd be seven.
Celibate.
I'm sorry?
So keep that in mind.
They're celibate?
Celibate. Yes.
Well, that wouldn't do for Russ.
No. But that's probably why there are so few, because, of course, no children.
Uh-huh. Well, that's yeah. I never thought of that.
Mm-hmm.
What about the adopting? Was that a real traditional thing? They had in
yeah,
the book
was,
they had five adopted children.
Yes, it was very flexible there, and the adoptions actually take place in cradle to grave. And I won't go into the whole thing, but those children literally had nowhere else to go,
mm-hmm.
so they took them in. But the Shakers, that's how they kept their numbers up for a while, is they adopted children. You have to think that there was a lot of death then from disease, a lot of widows, a lot of orphans.
Mm-hmm.
And if you found your way to a Shaker community, you would be taken care and joined. You would be taken care of.
Wow. You know,
that's how they did it.
I was a history major, and I focused pretty much on Western expansion, 1840 to 1890. But, you know, of course, you have to study the Revolutionary period and everything else. And one thing that was always amazing to me was the fact that a lot of the farms and the farmers used to take in orphan children and mm-hmm. and make them, and they were automatically their own kids. There wasn't even a legal adoption thing. It was just they brought them in, they started calling them their last name, and they became part of the family.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just always...
And luckily.
Well, yeah, yeah.
There's no safety net, and a lot of those children would have died without that kind of thing in effect.
True. True. Now, this story takes off, second or third chapter, I don't recall which, in which Will Reese gets into it with Mr. Ward,
mm-hmm.
Down someplace down by the tavern.
The tavern, yeah.
Yeah, they mm-hmm. think they were sucking up some ale or grog of some sort. And then shortly thereafter, Mr. Ward winds up deceased.
Yeah. But not at the tavern.
And then, of course, the magistrate comes and gets him and wants him to help him move the body. And then, lo and behold, that one didn't work, so another one wound up dead.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Well, the thing is that, you know, I mean, like Jim said in the third chapter, whatever, is that there's the murder.
Yeah.
We know there's a murder. We know who some of the suspects are.
Right.
And very briefly... Well, in the very beginning, Reese is kind of suspected also. That
right.
changes through the course. We don't want to give away, you know, anything about
no.
the story. And then also quite early in the story, there's the problem that the town basically thinks that Lydia is a witch.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And also we find out that that story was being propagated by someone else.
But, right.
Yeah. Which I told Jim earlier today. I said, you know, if I confronted someone who had done that to my wife, I would have kicked her butt. I mean, that was
yeah.
That was pretty malicious, that whole thing.
But I think that was pretty common.
And, of course, that's one of the things I wanted to write about, because that's kind of what happened in the witch trials. And then more and more people turned against the ones that were accused.
Yeah, the witch trials lasted for what? Not very long, but 5 years?
No. I don't even think it was that long. And, of course, there was a lot of reparations that were paid and all of that kind of stuff.
Right.
But all the people who were accused or were in the families moved out of Danvers, where it actually took place. It wasn't in Salem.
Mm-hmm.
And made a new village. I'm thinking because I couldn't face any of those people ever again.
Oh, I would imagine.
Do we know what the impetus of all of this accusation and where excuse me, where it all came from?
You mean in Salem?
Well, yeah. Like, why suddenly was this a big deal? Why are we looking at witches and accusing
people?
Well,
they're not entirely sure. One of the suggestions is that there were ergot poisoning. Ergot would grow on
in the rye bread.
Rye,
right.
During wet, and it was produced a toxin similar to LSD. And the other thing was that Samuel Parrish, who was the vicar or the minister of that town, believed in spectral evidence, and his daughter was one of the ones to make the first accusations. And some of the blame, they think, has been attached to Tituba, who was a slave, a black slave from Haiti. And personally, I think that the girls had something to do with it, because girls were supposed to be quiet and docile. This is
yeah,
their
those
one
were the good old days,
shine.
Huh?
Yeah,
sorry.
The good old days.
Sorry.
Yeah. So it was like the mean girls, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, I seem to recall that a lot of it had to do with the Puritanistic attitudes and the Puritans, because, mm-hmm. you know, everything had to be by the book.
Mm-hmm.
And if, you know, anybody lived outside of the realm of the Bible, they were labeled.
That's right.
And it didn't.
And they were very suspicious of outsiders.
Right.
And, yeah.
Right. But, I mean, now we're talking about Lydia Reese, and she's not an outsider. Well, she was a Shaker, so okay.
And she didn't grow up in that town.
Right.
She
was an outsider.
Somewhere else. And let me tell you, even in Maine now, they call people who, even from Massachusetts, they are from away.
Oh, is that right?
They're yes, and they're very suspicious of them, even now. My husband worked in a local hospital, and he would, while he's taking blood, he would have people say, all these people from away come and take our jobs. And he has a master's.
Hmm.
And they barely have high school. So there's still an attitude there of it's very insular, and there's still a suspicion of people who come from outside.
It really sounds similar to our current political climate.
It really
country,
does.
Doesn't
yes, it does.
It
yeah.
really does. I mean, here we don't have aways. We, you know.
Yes.
We have brown skins.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But I think California, New York, and a few other places, everybody's from away. So it's
the
same thing, you know.
Yeah. Actually, unless you're Mexican, you weren't originally from California. You know, everybody
That's
moved
true.
Here.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Everybody, all the Anglos moved here.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't any. Well, it's the same thing with Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado,
Texas,
Tejas. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's right. So,
but they, you know, like today, there's a lot of fear.
Yes. Well, there's it's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
But let's not digress down that road.
No, but
I got in trouble for that yesterday.
Sure, but I see a connection though. That again, it was the fear that probably propagated the witch accusations.
Right.
Where mm-hmm. you know, or either that, or let's look for a commonality that we can all jump on the bandwagon and have a common cause.
Sure.
Well, and fear, and of course, it was a superstitious time.
Right.
I mean, even in 1816, when I mentioned the last witch trial in New York, which took place in West Nyack, I think probably the woman was mentally ill. She was a widow of a pharmacist and would wander around talking to herself, strange clothes and all of that. And there was, I think people were afraid
mm-hmm.
of, so, look, but, you know, more than 100 years later, she was released. And Mother Ann Lee of the Shakers was arrested for blasphemy in New York in 1787. So there was still a lot of fear of things that were different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that's probably true, huh? There was a lot of stuff in this country that was weird.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're going to take a couple minutes out here, Eleanor, and we're going to do a few commercials, and then we're going to get back to you. We're going to give out the phone numbers, and we'll see how this 3D camera thing is working out. So hang tough. Don't go away. We'll be back to you in just a minute.
Okay.
By the way, it is working. Everybody's talking to us.
Good, good.
Yes, in fact, John Hagenberg wants to know where my mug is. He says, I've got mine. Where's yours? And I just... That's all I got.
You got one, don't you?
Yeah, I do.
I know. Okay. Anyway, you've typed your final period, you've stacked your last chapter, and you sat back in your chair and you said to yourself, oof, I am done. Nope, not even close. Sure, you finished your manuscript, but it takes a whole lot more to have a completed book. You know what it takes? Russ, do you know what it takes?
I don't. What is it?
Okay, it takes editing. And it takes rewriting and more editing and more rewriting and formatting and proofreading and more rewriting. And then if you're really lucky, you can devise a cover and maybe get some stuff done for a proof. And you can proof it. And then you need more rewriting and more editing. And then you can get some printed and you can have them on your coffee table or put them on a shelf and give them away to your friends, because that's what pretty much all the writers do. So... why not let the folks at Tuscany Bay Black Dog Books do that for you? For a very, very, very small investment, we can do all of the above for you and get you the finished book you dreamt about when you first started typing and help you get some bucks in your pocket as well. We are here for new writers. So if you haven't the foggiest idea what you're doing, we've learned it. We can share and help you get a book of which you can be proud. So give us a call at 805-795-3165 or email me at jchristina@tuscanybaybooks.com or rpaolinelli, P-A-O-L-I-N-E-L-L-I, at tuscanybaybooks.com. And if you want, you can just contact us, send us a manuscript, and we'll get back to you and see what we can do for you. Okay, Russ, you want to do your... all dogs rule?
Sure.
Okay.
All dogs rule. Who are they?
They're yours.
Yeah. Well, we're doing this off the cuff, I guess.
Well, you want a copy?
Sure. No. I've got it. Listen, I know
should,
so much
it's
about
your
this
business.
Place.
Okay.
Listen, we have probably the most elite dog boarding facility anywhere, and it's called All Dogs Rule. All Dogs Rule Day Camp and Sleepovers, and it's the place where your dog can go and be a dog. We have almost 20 acres of orange trees and dog parks and grass and trees and places where your dogs can run and play. But the dogs are kept in groups of 2, 3, or 4. They're just not all smashed together mm-hmm. trying to get mm-hmm. along. We have 24-hour on-site care. We do transportation all over Kaneo Valley. When your dog gets home from their vacation, they look at you, you look at them, and you're thinking, whose vacation was better? It was probably the dog's.
Yeah, except that my dog came in and peed on my living room floor because she was pissed that we left her.
No, well, there you go. Actually, that's what we taught her.
Yeah, well, thank you.
So she came through. That was
yeah,
that
she,
was
did. She did. It. She was good.
Yeah. Oh, gosh. Hey, anyhow, it's a great place. It's got competitive rates. It's just there's no finer place.
You do extra training. You do.
We can do training.
Yeah.
We can do specialized individual play times. We walk them around the ranch. We have a big 100-by-200-foot arena where we
right.
play chuck it or frisbee with the dogs.
There you go.
They just have a really good time.
Good.
So if you're interested, you can look at us up on the web at
yep.
www.alldogsrule.com, or you can call the office, which is 805-524-1100.
That's it. Okay, and it's All Dogs Rule, 805-524-1100. And F. Scott Fitzgerald states, life starts all over again when it gets crisp in the fall. Well, at Out West agrees. Time to rework your wardrobe and refresh your attitude. Add a leather or a suede jacket, but make sure you bring your wallet because those things are not cheap. Pull on a new pair of stylish boots, slip on a Johnny sweater or a wrap. A dash of cinnamon, a splash of cobalt blue, a warm red with a little apple in it.
Hot apple wine cider.
A swig of fringe and Out West Shop has just what you need to spice your life up with a touch of the West. So shop online at www.outwestshop.com for the best of fine goods inspired by the West. Or you can call 877-340-9378, and you can talk to Bobby Jean or Jim Bell, and it's always a great day out west. And if you put in code WB9, if you order online, you get $10 off your order.
So okay, what's the 9, WB9?
I don't know. It's right after WB8. Okay. I have no idea.
Next month it'll be 10, right?
Probably. Okay. We are back at 7:30. We are on the line with Eleanor Kuntz. And our number here in the studio, if you want to call and talk to her, is 818-602-4929. Again, that number is 818-602-4929. And seeing as though my mouse is working tonight, I will be able to answer the phone, and I promise I will not hang up on you.
All right. And we are back on Facebook Live again.
We are back on Facebook Live. And again, if you're watching this pod or watching the show live on Facebook, go to the live broadcast because you can hear our guest as well.
Yes. Otherwise, you just hear
us banter, and you have no idea what we're talking about because we look like two idiots, two monkeys in a cage. That's pretty much it. Okay, Eleanor, we're back with you. You didn't leave us. Okay. I thought, oh, no, she hung up. No, she didn't. Okay. All righty. So we've gone through your book a little bit, and let's talk some about your process. But when you sit down and write, when is that? And how long do you try to write for? Do you have a schedule? How do you do it? Because every writer is different.
I try to write early in the morning because before I go to work, actually, because then if I'm struggling with a thorny plot problem or something with the character, I think about it on my commute.
Okay.
So the next morning, I've kind of have it all straightened out in my head.
Uh-huh. Do you make notes? Do you make like a vocal record notes or write them down as you? Well, if you're driving, you can't. But you know, do you make like tape recorder notes?
No, I don't. When I make notes is actually during the edits. I have a notebook, and when I read it through after the first draft is done, I write all the things that I notice that need to be changed.
Mm-hmm.
Problems with chronology, problems with names. I've changed the name somewhere around the middle and didn't realize it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I go through and rewrite all of that, and then I do the same thing over and over and over until I get down to very few notes.
Oh, okay.
Right. Now
that works.
Okay, I've got a question. Because, Eleanor, I am not a writer.
No, he's not.
So when you... Like this book that we're talking about, The Cold Dish, when you go to decide how the story's going to go, do you do anything like you would do if you do a film? Like, do you have a storyboard, or do you use cards to write out and you know how the plot's going to go, or do you kind of just kind of feel it as you go and write?
Apparently... And I learned this only after I was a published writer. There are two kinds of writers. They call them the plotter and the pantser.
The pants, seat of your pants.
The pantser, yes. And that's the kind I am.
Me too.
I do a fair amount of research ahead of time, and then research is kind of ongoing to make sure that what I'm writing about could actually have happened. But I almost never know where I'm going.
Mm-hmm.
I almost never know who the murderer is going to be. And there are times I have had to rewrite because I've become fond of a character, and I don't want that character to be the murderer now. So I have to go back and rewrite it. And I like what Lee Child said, that he always feels that if he did a whole outline, then he wouldn't want to write the book because it would be boring because he would know what was going to happen.
Sure.
Interesting.
And I kind of feel that way, too. So usually after I've done a certain amount of research and I have a couple of scenes kind of laid out in my head, I just start writing.
Well, that's, I mean,
and
that,
that's,
go ahead. No, you go ahead.
that's one reason why I do quite a bit of editing, because I change my mind on the way through.
Mm-hmm. You know, I do you, a lot of writers, I mean, we've had, oh, golly, what, over three and a half years on this show. And we get a different answer from almost everybody. But in one question that we ask is always the same answer without, well, I don't think there's ever been any kind of a, no, I don't think anyone's ever disagreed. And they all say the same thing, is that when they're pantsers, they allow their character to dictate where they're going to go next in the book.
That's right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Do you ever wake up in the middle of the night and you just had a sudden idea, oh, this is where we're going to go tomorrow? And you know, you,
yes,
just, you do that.
I do. And one of your earlier shows, one of the authors talked about how sometimes the characters take over and surprise you.
Absolutely.
That happens to me all the time.
Right. Right.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. It does me too.
Wow.
I mean, Lydia, in the beginning, in The Simple Murder, which was the first book, was supposed to be basically a walk-on character. When Reese was interviewing Shakers because of a murder, she needed to be a chaperone for him while he was interviewing the sisters, the women.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we know what happened. She took over.
Yeah. And now look at her. Five books in, she's pregnant.
Yep. Yeah, and she's you know, one of the major characters.
Right.
Well, I had not intended that to happen.
Right.
So it was as much as a surprise to me as everyone else, really.
Let me ask, when you started with this whole series, did you have any thought that it would go as far as it did? Or it, like, we've interviewed some authors who said, you know, I knew this was going to be like a five-book series.
Right.
I knew where I was starting. I knew where I wanted to end. And I just had to fill in the in-between.
Right.
Well, I knew that I wanted it to be a series, and that's partly from being a librarian. People love series, and they read from the first book to the last book in order. I still don't know where this is going to end. Hopefully, we'll continue on for a little ways, because now I know the characters, and I have ideas for, well, The Shaker Murders is coming out in February. The second book, I'm working on the edits now. I'm mostly through the book after that. I already know where I want to send them for the book after that.
Mm-hmm.
So it just kind of keeps going.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you said you're a librarian.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, where's your place of employment? What library?
It's a Goshen County. It's the Goshen Public Library. It's a medium-sized library in Orange County, New York.
Gotcha. Okay, so this mm-hmm. is a full-time profession for you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you ever feel that you would like to get to a point where you don't have to have that job anymore, or is writing work for you where it's something you do in your off time and that's more rewarding for you?
Mm-hmm.
I think that eventually I'm going to have to quit my job as a librarian because I don't have time to do as much of the writing as I would like. With that said, I've always loved being a librarian, and in a lot of ways, it's a good complement to being a writer. It's a very social job. You're with people all the time, and I think being a writer can be pretty solitary.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Mm-hmm. When you're locked in your office from, like, you know.
I would have a hard time doing something where I was, you know, just in an office,
yeah,
or just by myself all
yeah.
the time. Now, some of the authors. Oh, go ahead, please.
But, you know, the problem really is that you only have a certain amount of hours in a day.
Right.
And I started another series that takes place in Bronze Age Crete. I don't even want to talk about the research for that one. And the research for two series and edits and publicity and all of that really is a full-time job. And if you already have a full-time job, you know, doesn't really leave a lot of time for other things, so...
And you really enjoy this.
I may be forced into it.
But yeah. You really enjoy this, don't you?
Well, the problem is you do have to sleep.
Yes, exactly. And you do have to eat. And you
right.
do have to, you know, you're married, and you do have to spend a little time with your spouse. So.
Let them come in your office and say hi or walk by and wave.
I can see a,
that,
that's what
I
happens
think
at my house.
Yeah.
I can see a lot of spouses now going to their spouse and saying, hey, why don't you become a writer and go be secretary?
That's true. Have you ever given any thought to giving to, I'm sure that you are asked this question, and more than one book signing, I'm absolutely certain. Any advice to new writers that you would want to give out that you would, you know, because this show is geared towards new writers, and if you got any advice for new writers, let them have it.
Well, I usually tell them the main thing is not to give up, because I think there are probably plenty of people who are better writers than I am, but they gave up.
Mm-hmm.
And like any craft, you have to start at a certain point and practice until you get better and better and better.
Sure.
And eventually you get published. And I think a lot of people who may have a lot of talent don't let that process unroll. They give up first.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like we discussed the other night on the phone. A lot of new writers think, you know, all they have to do is write a book and, you know.
Exactly.
And then put it on a shelf and they're going to make $1 million. And that's just not true, you know.
Right. There are plenty of writers who've been writing a very long time.
Right.
And still have jobs that pay the bills.
Right, right. There's like six words that we live by, and that's don't give up your day job.
You're right. Exactly.
I'm told that daily.
But you
and of course,
that is your day job.
A lot. Why we're all still working, right?
Exactly. Well, I mean, you know, there's a lot of writers out there that are outstanding and they're exceptional, and the, you know, they don't go anywhere, and it's not because they're a bad writer, not because they don't try. It's just because I think part of the deal is now that there are so many people trying to put books out there.
Mm-hmm.
And unless you've got a genre that is really not overpopulated, which a lot of them are right now, that you're really, I mean, your friends are going to read your stuff, and you're probably your mother and your dad and, you know, a couple people and next door neighbors. But for general thing, it's just not going to go anywhere. I mean, and you've maybe written a bestseller, but nobody's ever going to know.
Well, also,
the
too,
other
I think,
thing I oh, think is that people are creatures of habit.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, one of the things I do a lot of as a librarian is what we call, the publishers call hand selling, and I call reader's advisory. And you help people find books.
Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of books read the same authors over and over and over, even if they don't like them anymore.
Yeah.
It's a habit.
It's a habit. It's like a good example of that, and that's a very good point. A good example of that is I used to fly a lot. I used to fly out, go everywhere. And I would go to the airport bookstore, and the first thing I would look for is a John Sanford book.
Mm-hmm.
And John Sanford writes some really good books. They're a lot of fun to read, and they read fast. And there's always, you go to the airport, there's always a new one, you know. And that was me. That was my thing. I liked to read John Sanford on the air. Well, we got to interview John Sanford on this show. I was thrilled because I was a big fan. But
yeah, he's a great writer.
He is. He's a lot of fun, too, I have to tell you. But, you know, I wouldn't look at another author. I wouldn't. I wouldn't look at another one. It would just be, if they didn't have a John Sanford book, I'd go to the other bookstore because...
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And I know a lot of people who read exactly as Eleanor just said. They pick an author, and that's what they stick with.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I was guilty
exactly.
of that. Yeah.
Well, I know that I have some favorite authors. Like Eleanor, you mentioned Lee Childs, and I'm a big fan of the Jack Reacher series. And every once in a while, there's one that comes along, and I'll read it, and I go, it was okay.
Yeah.
But... Yeah. You know, if he's written 20 of them, you know, I have to say probably 17 were really good.
Yeah.
So for the three, you just say, okay, well, that was not as enjoyable, but
yeah.
They're all good.
Yeah.
They're all fun. And I always look to see if he's got a new one coming out. But he always says November 7th every year he comes out with a new one.
Well, see?
Yeah.
He's got it. Let me ask you something, because this is a question we ask all our writers, and I'm sure that you know what the question is going to be because of the name of the show. Have you ever had writer's block? And if you have, what did you do to get rid of it?
I don't really think I've ever had writer's block, which is a good thing because I don't really have the time. But
that's a great answer now, by itself.
There's an, Bobby Jean, if you're listening, write that one down.
But if I'm at a sticky place in the plot, or I'm not really sure to go with it, what I usually do is take myself out of Will Reese's mind or Lydia's mind, and I try to picture the story from the viewpoint of another character. And somehow that always works for me. It gives you a whole new perspective of where things might be going, or a different twist. Maybe that's why there's so many characters, because I have to keep doing it.
Well, that's a point. I suppose I never really thought of it that way. Do you like writing dialogue?
I do. I don't think I'm as good at it as some of the people. Like you read Archer Mayer? His dialogue
No.
is wonderful, and you can tell who's speaking without anybody saying, you know, Kunkel or anything. He's just so good at it.
And let me ask you one final question before we start wrapping up, because we are running out of time. When you've picked names for your characters, or even if you have a minor character that you have to name, where do you get your names? Because I've been asked that probably 100 times.
Well, I struggle with names, quite honestly. So frequently I go back to history books and I look at the names that were popular at that time. Like one of the children is named Jerusa. Very popular name at that time. I'm sure nobody is named Jerusa now.
I have a client named Jerusha. I
do.
I do, absolutely. And I was amazed when she came in, and she's young. She's probably not even 30 years old. And when she said, my name's Jerusha, and I said, wait a minute. So, and I had her spell it.
Spell it, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And it's one of those names that will stick in my head forever.
Oh, absolutely.
Yep. It's a biblical name, actually.
Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah, I found that, you know, because I write Westerns, and I've learned that, you know, names like Bob Evans, that's not a Western guy. Now, Stinky Randall, that's a Western guy.
Stinky.
And where do you get your names? Do you look at the history of the time?
Yeah, I do. I do. I did my last book, Jonah Blue. Jonah is, of course, a biblical name, and Blue was a derivative of the French Bleu, and that was his original name, was Jonah Blue. And this whole book came to me in a dream, so that's where that name came from.
Yeah, but the guy who was the trapper that he
Was Rensfeld Doggett.
Yeah, great name. I like that one.
Well, there's
You'll
another.
Never forget that one.
No, there's another character in there named Malachi Throne. Now, how many people are named Malachi?
Right.
You know,
and yet that was a very popular name for a while.
Yes, it was in the 1830s. So anyway, you want to give our audience your email and web and all that good stuff, that good information,
sure.
If you would, please.
My email is Eleanor, Eleanor. Kuhns@gmail.com. My website is eleanor-kuhns.com. And I am on Facebook. If you Google my name, you'll come up with Eleanor Kuhns, writer, historical murder mysteries.
Okay.
And I am also on Twitter.
Okay.
Hashtag Eleanor Kuhns.
Okay. And we don't ask for phone numbers. But
okay.
We already have yours, so.
Okay.
Well, Eleanor, thank you so much for spending an evening with. I know that it's getting late there. It's what, 10 minutes to 11?
Yes.
So, and you've got to be getting a little tired, and I appreciate you staying up and playing with us for an hour. It was fun.
It was wonderful. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for joining us. And I have to say that, you know, your book was phenomenal. Russ and I both enjoyed it.
Absolutely.
And you know, let us know when that other one comes out in February. Give the bookie a holler. And who is your publicist, incidentally?
PJ Nunn.
Okay. That's okay. Because we just got another one from PJ. We deal a lot with her, so she's good. Okay, well, thank you so much for joining us, and enjoy the rest of your evening, and we'll be talking soon.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks, Eleanor. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Eleanor Koons.
Yeah, she's
nice lady.
I like her.
Yeah, she was a fun guest.
You know what one of the most fun things about the show is that you read these books, mm-hmm. and then having the opportunity to talk to the person whose mind it came out.
Exactly.
Isn't
that fun?
It's fascinating.
And then, you know, the people who have never written or are thinking about writing or are struggling, you know, they listen to the show and they, you know, I had one guy send me an email. He goes, you know, I get so many good ideas off this show. He says, I don't want to miss it.
Wow.
You know, and he even was in L.A. and he moved to Iowa. So I you know, that's the kind of people we have. Okay, next week we have with Bob Brill and Bobby Jean will be back with us. We have Axel Howerton and his book Con Morte, or in Italian, that's With Death. So I assume I haven't started on it yet, but I'm going to probably tomorrow or Saturday. And with Bob and Bobby Jean, it'll be a three way again.
Okay,
I know. I just shouldn't have gone there. Okay.
Although Bobby keeps hoping.
Well, Bobby keeps saying it. Yeah. So okay. So anyway, for Russ.
Yeah,
thank
that's
you.
Me over here.
That is you.
You're
thank you so much for joining us. For those of you who watched our show live, God bless you. To Eleanor Koons, thank you so much again for joining us. It was a lot of fun. And, of course, what is her name of her book again? I keep forgetting.
The Devil's Cold Dish.
The Devil's Cold Dish.
Yes.
1797 takes place.
Yes,
in
98.
Maine, in Maine. And, of course, for myself, Jim Christina, for Russ Aviston, it has been fun having everybody here, but we are out of here.